all of you who've heard this before know what that signals. Yet another fireside chat, as I like to call these. Although it's really kind of funny, because even though I have a fireplace, I'm not sitting by the fireplace when I'm doing these. So technically it's a sort of in the vicinity of the fireside that I can see, but not really by the fireside. Be that as it were, thank you for all your listeners for continuing to support my show, so to speak. For those of you who are music aficionados, you may or may not recognize that piece. That was definitely a deep cut. Most of you know the band that did that for things like Crossroads, White Room, and Sunshine of Your Love. So that was obviously, you know, the quote-unquote cream version. that actually first appeared on their record Fresh Cream, which was released, I think, in January of 1967, both in the UK and the US, I think by Atco Records. May be mistaken. You aficionados may want to check me on that one. The funny thing about it is, you know, as a lot of you know, a lot of your British and your American folks were doing songs by very, you know, well-heeled African-American blues artists, but weren't necessarily crediting them with them. And to Cream's credit, they credited Skip James as being the author of that song that I just played, which in fact he was. That was, I think, originally done in 1931. He was inspired, which people may or may not know, by a song written in 1927 called So Tired, and I think it was by George Little and Art Sizemore, if I'm not mistaken. But again, you music buffs out there and audiophiles need to check me up on that, because I wouldn't, you know, swear to Jesus, God, Buddha, Satan, and any other deity that that's absolutely accurate. That song also appeared, again, as many of you know who are Cream freaks like I am, on their Cream's last studio album, Goodbye Cream is a live version. So along with Sitting on Top of the World. And, you know, the good news about this whole thing for me is that, unlike a lot of, British and American artists who sort of, shall we say, borrowed from other folks, and didn't necessarily credit their contribution to them, some of those folks being some of my favorite bands, unfortunately, for which I'm a little ashamed to say, but it's absolutely true. Cream was, honest and said who they got the song from and who the song was written by, and did the same thing about all the songs that they borrowed from a lot of the great blues guys, including Chester Burnett, Howling Wolf, and the other folks that they did, Muddy Waters, that they did songs from. So woohoo to them for doing that. They didn't have to be sued to do that, so that was really cool. the reason I chose that song really was because the topic tonight of the podcast is about choosing one's own mental health. And someone a while back, you know, sent me an article about Dr. William Glasser, who, for those of you who are not psych or freaks out there, mental health freaks out there, may or may not know, he's the author of Reality Therapy and a book later in his career called Choice Theory. And Glasser is the guy that coined and invented so-called reality therapy, one of the therapies that I like to use a lot and really, really, really incorporate a lot of his techniques into the stuff that I do. And I think he passed in late August of 2013 in LA, I think. And I know he was in the late 80s, I think maybe 88, 89. But at any rate, one of his caveats was that mental health is mostly a matter of a personal choice, that people can choose to be happy or they can choose not to be happy. That became much more apparent when he published in his late 90s the book Choice Theory, A New Psychology on Personal Freedom, where he talks about that other people can neither make us miserable nor make us happy, that choice theory teaches us that we are much more in control of our lives than we realize, and that is something I absolutely support. some of you may know Glasser from an earlier book, that he did, including Reality Therapy and Schools Without Failure and, you know, a bunch of stuff that I can't even remember at this point. But his basic tenets were a drug-free, living a drug-free life, and that includes psychotropics as much as possible, and that the core principles in his theory essentially were that the only person who controls his or her own emotional status is that person himself or herself, that people have no power to make anybody anything, and I train my people in that every frickin' day. That's part of, by the way, what I mean when I say to you folks that have been so generous to listen to my show for as long as you have, and I really thank you. I know I say that every time, but I really, really mean it. It means a lot to me that folks are following me and listening to my stuff and liking what they hear. Honestly, and I don't say this to be mean or you know, smug or anything else, I really wouldn't care if people liked it or not, in the sense that I'm going to say what's true or what I believe to be true or what I know to be true from research studies as much as I possibly can. And if folks don't like the truth, then what I say is alter your life so that the truth makes your life better, you know, and that's what you guys and gals hear me talking about. Take your frickin' power back. You have heard me say that again and again and again and again. And that is a core principle of a lot of the therapies that I use, Glasser being amongst them, right? So what he also says is that the effort to change other people, you know, try to get the world to suit your needs and your wishes and your desires, whether they be rational, as Albert Ellis might say, or irrational, another man I really admire his work on, is, you know, that any efforts to change the outside world essentially are doomed. And those are, in fact, the result, or the cause, I should say, of most emotional issues that people face. Now, again, none of these folks, including myself, are, you know, idiotic enough to say, well, every single mental health problem in the world is caused by your viewpoint and your emotional status. And, you know, and Albert Ellis was certainly a proponent of that, you know, who took all of his work from Epictetus, the famous Greek Stoic philosopher, who once said, men are not disturbed by things or events, but by their interpretation of them. And he was exactly right. Shakespeare also later echoed that statement, I believe, in the play Hamlet, when he says, you know, there is nothing that is good nor bad that thinking doesn't make it so, or some similar quote to that. I may have that a little bit wrong, but I think you folks get where I'm going, right? People are in control of their own world, of their own internal world, right? And if one's going to be true to oneself, that's really the only thing that's going to make somebody happy, you know. Now, again, barring some major brain foobar coming out of the chute, you know, with weird wiring or foobarred brain chemistry, or you get some, you know, weird, you know, accident that happens and you have brain trauma, or you know, have an allergic reaction to cheese or wheat or some chemical that you shouldn't have been taking to begin with, or maybe some chemical that you did, like penicillin, and you had some weird aberrant reaction to penicillin that, you know, messed up your brain wiring. I mean, short of that kind of thing, the basic, you know, idea is that mental health is largely, you know, a situation of choice. And that is absolutely true. And that's part of what I've tried to say to you folks time and time and time and time and time and time and time again, that we choose our own happiness. We choose our own sadness, barring major biochemical or brain wiring issues. We mostly choose our own emotional states. Now, that's not to say that there are things that happen in life that can encourage us to feel sad or scared or unhappy or depressed or dejected or hurt or whatever. But that's to say is we don't have to suffer, as Shakespeare might say, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You know, we have choices to make, both what we do behaviorally and what we do inside our head by changing our thoughts. Because what we know is that changing our thoughts basically change the wiring of our brain over time. You know, so for example, you know, and people may be going, what the hell is that guy talking about? Has he lost his rock, or has he had too much, you know, limeade with stevia in it or something? No, actually, although I am drinking that at the current moment, without the addition of any ethanol or methanol substances to inebriate my current cognitive functioning. Or for those of you who don't get that, I'm not drunk or drinking anything that would make me drunk. As most of you know, I almost never drink, and I've never been drunk or anything else in my entire life because I'm basically a nerd, as I've said to you guys many, many times ago. But you know, the good news of nerds is If they don't smoke and they don't do drugs and they don't do stupid other drugs that are legal, like sugar, which I don't do much of, hardly ever, although this is certainly the time of year when my resolve gets put to the test when I go to various parties that have delights there that I know have sugar in them. And I sometimes just say, what the hell, and go ahead and do them anyway. But I don't do a lot of them. And usually I, you know, that's the only time of the year I do anything really dumb in terms of eating horrible food for the most part. But my point being, I know, you know, if you don't contaminate your brain, you have a lot of chemistry to work on when the fit hits the shan, because there isn't a single one of us who hasn't experienced disappointment. There isn't a single one of us who hasn't experienced frustration or anger or felt hurt or insulted or left out or deprived or abused, right? And some of us have been abused physically and emotionally. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that people can't say things that most the average individual wouldn't find hurtful or upsetting or anger-inducing or whatever. But what I'm suggesting is that you don't have to stay in that state. The more you practice what you feel and what you do, the better at it you become, right? Yeah, all of you folks who are listening to this podcast know that intuitively. You just don't know that you know it intuitively, and I'm going to tell you how you know it, right? So for those of you who are keyboardists, right, whether it's a typewriter or a computer keypad or a, you know, I call keyboards of the, you know, Roland, Casio, Akai, you know, the real deal keyboards, the piano keyboard type things, or, you know, piano-like instruments, you know. I consider all of those very similar because they're similar motor skills. You know, any of you who are keyboardists of any variety know that the first time you go to type on a computer or a typewriter or a laptop, or the first time you folks tried to do a synthesizer or a piano, digital or otherwise, you probably sucked, right? I did. I mean, it took me a while to learn to type when I back in the day when I was first typing on a real typewriter. And some of you probably never seen one of those. I mean, God forbid. Oh my God! I just mentioned how old I am. Oh my God! You know, heaven forbid I'm an old nerd fart, right? Anyway, I am, but that's another story. So, at any rate, you know, when I first learned to type, it was on this little teeny manual typewriter, not electric, not electronic, right? This is like, you know, back in the days when dinosaurs ruled the earth. And, you know, you really had to exert some force on those bad puppies to make them whap the keys onto the paper in order to transfer the ink from the keys and the ink cartridge to the paper. But anyway, you had, you know, the faster you got, the quicker you could type, and that required that nasty four-letter word work. Oh my frickin' God, he said it again? Oh, gosh, is he ever going to stop saying that word? No! Because if you want to be successful in life, that's what it takes. Get used to it. Belly up to the bar of reality and get used to it, okay? So I had to practice like a crazy person to get that typewriter to work the way I wanted it to work, right? Those skills transferred really well when I, you know, discovered electric typewriters and then, of course, computers and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, when you talk about other keyboards, you know, such as those one sees in a music store, I don't practice those enough to be any good. So, I mean, I know where the keys are, I know where the notes are, and my fingers kind of know where to go if I'm incredibly slow, but I haven't created enough neural pathways. I haven't practiced it enough for my brain to create an interstate highway, right, to go from my brain to my fingers so that my motor muscles are just going, you know, like crazy, so that I can actually sound like something other than, you know, a dead cat flopping on the keys right before he dies, you know. Sorry for you cat lovers out there, I'm one myself. But, you know, the reality is I have to stop and, quote unquote, think about it, right? Now, if I could play keyboards really, really well, like the chick I jam with, Marianne, who is a fabulous keyboard player, even though she would not tell you that, she's a fabulous keyboard player, trust me, and I'm not one to give compliments out capriciously. She's a really good keyboard player. At any rate, you know, she does this stuff almost without thinking. Well, obviously she's thinking about it, but she's practiced it so much. You know, how much has she practiced it? She's practiced it so much that it has moved from her prefrontal lobes to the back burner of her brain on the so-called automatic, right? Now, it's nearly not automatic because she had to practice like a crazy woman to get it to be automatic, okay? But once you, I talk about it like paving a road through a jungle or through the countryside, right? When you're using a dirt road, think about how the car juggles and tussles, and, you know, it's a real uncomfortable ride, right? It, and your tires are bouncing, and you're bouncing up and down. You know, and unless you have a really, 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 really comfortable car that cost a boatload of money, you're joggling around, and you're like, when the hell are we getting off this freaking redneck road and getting on something that's got pavement on it, right? Well, then you come back a couple of years later, and they've turned it into an interstate, and you're like, oh, my God, thank you, Jesus, right? And you're driving on the road, and it's a whole lot better ride. Think of automatic thoughts as being that. You are the construction crew going through a jungle or going through a field or a cornfield or a forest or a mountain, and you got to blow the stuff up and lay the blacktop and cut the roads, and it's really hard work, and road cars that are going there or trucks that are going on there before you get that thing cut through are really having a hard time. Once you, and they're trying to find another way to get around there because they don't want to muck with that stuff, right? Now, after you get the road cut, the cars are going down and like crazy, and everybody wants to go down that road. It's an easy no-brainer. Learned behavior is the same way, particularly motor skills, right? So you get used to doing a keyboard, whatever that keyboard is for you, right? You become really good, and now you don't have to, quote-unquote, think about it as much. It goes to the back part of your brain, and it becomes sort of what most people call, quote-unquote, automatic. But it's not really automatic, because if it was automatic, everybody, one of us could do it coming out of the chute, right? And pretty much the only thing most of us can do coming out of the chute is scream and cry and whine and breathe and pump oxygen and blood and poop and piss, right? Just about everything else is learned behavior, okay? And walking and motor skills are certainly no exception to that. If you don't believe me, go see somebody who has had a brain injury through a car accident or whatever, and watch them learn to rewalk or learn to retype or whatever, and you'll realize really quickly this stuff is not automatic. It's hard work. You do so long ago, you don't think about it anymore. Neither do I. But it ain't automatic, right? No brain, no gain, okay? So emotions are the same way. If you practice being angry, if you practice being a victim, and do the, oh, poor me thing, you know, and whiner, bitcher, moaner, complainer. If you practice being histrionic, an overreactor, you know, all the world's a stage and I'm the main actor in it, and everybody, it's all about you, isn't it? Right, to quote a line from Galaxy Quest, one of my favorite funny movies. So, you know, if you practice anything, anger, happiness, contentment, self-fulfillment, anything, if you practice that emotion, your brain secretes different chemicals and makes different neuronal connections in your brain. And over time, if you do it enough, those connections become quote unquote automatic. You pave the interstate highway and it's not a rocky road anymore, right? But in the first couple of months or years or whatever it takes, it's a really rocky road, right? And the other problem is most of us pave the way for anger, for resentment, for hatred, for jealousy, for being put upon and being powerless to do anything. That's why it pisses me off when I hear these addicts going to 12 say, oh, I'm powerless. No, you aren't. You are not powerless any more than I am. Get off your frickin' butt and take your damn power back and stop giving it away to God, Jesus, Buddha, Satan, Allah, the AA group, and every frickin' body else on the planet. You have power. You gave your damn power away. Get off your ass and get it back. Don't keep reinforcing the notion that you're powerless. You are not powerless any more than I am or anybody listening to this podcast is. You're just not. Stop deluding yourself. Start brainwashing yourself. Stop creating neural pathways that are going to be hard to undo, because what you practice, you become good at. And what you become good at becomes habitual. And what becomes habitual becomes a bitch to stop doing, right? Boom. Right? Or if I were Cicero, I would say nothing is stronger than tradition. And that's what he's talking about, friends and neighbors. What you practice, you get really freaking good at. Now you want to practice doing something that's in complete opposite of what you're doing, right? So instead of being helpless or powerless or being a victim, right? And there's a difference between being victimized and being a victim. There's two differences. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, too. And I probably said that on a previous podcast, but it bears repeating, friends and neighbors. So if you practice being pissed off, frustrated, anxious, stressed, depressed, hyper, what the hell ever, and it's not due because you had too many Twinkies or you overtook your Ritalin because you're ADHD and you decided you wanted to get hyper as fuck, or you didn't want to take it and you sold it to your cousin who doesn't have ADHD because your cousin's a meth freak and can't get, you know, his methamphetamines, and he's going to crush four of your, you know, Concertas and snort them or whatever. Now, that's a different issue, right? But if you're a person who's used to doing whatever negative emotion you're doing, you're going to have a much easier time defaulting to that, because your brain is wired just like electricity in a sense. And even though the nerves aren't essentially touching like wires in a electric circuit are, right, what does electricity do? That's right, friends and neighbors. It takes the path of least resistance, and so does your brain. So it's all energy. Think of it as energy. Right? Think of it as energy, electricity, however you want to, you know, chi, ki, aura, soul, whatever you want to call it. But think of it as energy. And I'm not trying to get funky and woo. I'm just, you know, making analogies here for, you know, folks who come from differing backgrounds. So whatever energy, physics force that you're creating by creating the chemical in your brain, the neurochemicals in your brain, they are generating pathways. They are cutting pathways and making connections to other nerve cells in your brain, whether they're emotional nerve cells, cognitive, psychomotor, it doesn't matter, right? Everything's connected. You can't get around it. Everything in your brain is a neural network. What do you think all these computer geeks get their terms from? That's right. They stole them from the human brain. All a computer really is, and I'm not minimizing it because obviously it's a great thing I'm using it to do this with, right? And unlike most of my geek buddies who do this, you know, in their sleep, I'm a drooling moron with this stuff because I'm not very mechanically inclined and I don't practice it enough. And let's face it, I'm scared witless of some of this stuff. And I kind of got it on there and I feel like, you know, Scarlett O'Hara, I mean, not Scarlett O'Hara, Prissy on Gone with the Wind going, Lolly was Scarlett, I don't know nothing about no computers, right? And I literally, I'm like some little girl freaking out and going, oh, Lolly. You know, and if I'm doing that, you can bet your booties, my brain is not thinking in terms of compensation. My brain is thinking in terms of victim, right? So that's the very thing I don't need to be doing, right? That is counterintuitive to somebody who's coping, right? So I really have to get myself psyched up to do computer stuff because I have a fear of it, because my brain isn't normally wired in a way that computers and electronics and mechanical reasoning things make sense to me. But I know that if I take it really, really slowly, you know, like, you know, 3 or 4 years to, you know, plug the thing in or something, I can eventually do it. Right, I'm just a whole lot slower at doing it than most folks, and certainly, you know, light years slower than my geek friends who are just, you know, oh, dude, are you kidding me? And just boom, and they do it, right? But we all have different gifts. We all have different weaknesses. But if you freak yourself out about it, like I have a tendency to do with some things, I have to remind myself, I'm not helpless. Stop acting like a helpless little three-year-old. You are not a freaking helpless three-year-old. Get off your complacency, stop being a victim, and stop looking for somebody else to do your freaking work for you. Same thing with drugs. What do you think drugs are? Whether your drug is sugar, and yes, I know I've said this before, but I'll say this again, right? Sugar is a drug. From a pharmacological viewpoint, anything anybody puts into their body to be used by chemistry for your body is a drug. That means water, sugar, proteins, amino acids, lipids, you know, fats, chlorophyll, along with alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, tobacco, you know, tobacco basically, you know, tetranine, delta hydrocannabinol, THC, which is in pot, you know, heroin, you know, whatever. They're all drugs. So what we're really talking about is putting good drugs in your body and bad drugs in your body. What's a good drug for you? One that helps your brain and body function better, that isn't going to kick you in the butt later on, and in the appropriate dosage and time frame for your body. And if you're allergic to a drug, that drug may be great for somebody who isn't allergic to it, like penicillin. But if you're allergic to penicillin like I am and you have auditory and visual hallucinations, that ain't a good drug for your butt, okay? I already figured that one out as a kid, you know, and I think I've told the story before, so I won't, you know, ear burn anybody else again. But the one experience I've had with penicillin was pretty frightening at about 8 or 9 years old when I was seeing stuff and hearing stuff in my room that wasn't there. Yeah, I don't get hives. I get delusions, you know, so I stay away from that stuff. But it's a great drug if you're not allergic to it. Same thing with wheat. Wheat and gluten are fine drugs if you're not allergic to them. If you're allergic to them, they're horrible, right? It's the most whey products are the most bioavailable protein shakes on the amongst the most bioavailable protein shakes on the planet. They're the best protein shakes for you. Not if you're allergic to it. So a good drug is one you're not allergic to, that you're taking proper dosages at the right time, that's going to help your body and your brain, that's not going to kick you in the butt later. Right? So obviously steroids are a bad drug, because if you take steroids, they have short-term gains, but they have long-term pains. Bad drug. Right? Bad idea. So, you know, everything you do is a drug. Right? So if you're creating chemistry in your head, those are forms of internal drugs. Right? What do you think endorphins are? Right? The feel-good chemicals in our head when we get, you know, hurt and the endorphins kick in so we don't feel pain and kind of space us out. Those are endogenous opioid peptides. Translation, your body produces natural heroin and opium so that you, A, don't know how much danger and or pain you're in, and B, to numb you from the pain so you can get the heck out of the way while the bear's chasing in the wood after he took a chomp out of your leg. Okay? Yeah, if you didn't have that, a lot of us would be dead. Right? Adrenaline. It's a drug. It's a great drug if you got somebody chasing your ass with a lead pipe and you're, you know, 12:30 at night and you're running to get to your car. You better have some adrenaline, right? But just to pop adrenaline or take any kind of speed or amphetamine on a regular basis, that mucks your body up. So if you create chemistry in your body, you are dysregulating the biochemistry of your body every time you have a fear reaction, a self-pity reaction, an anger reaction, a happy reaction. Wouldn't you rather have more happy chemicals in your body? I know that sounds like, it's a wonderful day in the neighborhood, right? So just forgive me for that one, okay? But it's true. You know, happy chemicals relax your body. You know, you don't want anxiety-inducing chemicals in your body. You don't want depression-inducing chemicals in your body. You don't want anger-inducing chemicals in your body on a long-term basis. That's not good for your body. You don't want fight-or-flight, laudamascalet chemicals going on in your body. That's not good for your body, unless a bear's chasing you in the woods. And most of us don't have that, unless we live in Alaska or somewhere we go hunting a lot, right? So my point being, if you start thinking that you're helpless, you begin to create those neural pathways that reinforce the feeling of helplessness. You create the chemistry that creates the neural pathways. And every time you say to yourself inside your head, oh my God, it's awful and terrible, I just can't stand it, it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to me, oh my God, my life is over, I'm just this poor victim, poor me, oh my God, I was born a poor black child, oh my God, to quote Steve Martin in The Jerk, oh my God, you know, I can't do anything, whine, bitch, moan, complain, okay? The more you do that, the more you believe it. And the more your brain believes it, the more your brain goes, okay, I get it. I'm supposed to feel put upon, victimized, guilty, angry, pissed off, whatever, right? And then your brain enacts it, and your brain creates the neural pathways. It starts laying the tar and the the blacktop and the gives you the interstate. And now when the fit hits the shan, you go down the interstate. Why would you want to go through the jungle and have a rough ride? So when you try to stop doing that, your brain, quote unquote, does what you trained it to do. It goes down the interstate, even if the interstate's not good for you, because that's what you know. Nothing is stronger than tradition. Remember the Cicero quote, right? These guys were such geniuses. Holy moly, it just blows my mind how smart these guys were. Anyway, so now you have to, you know, cut out your machetes and get out your tar and start chomping. You know, you got to run through the jungle, to quote ACCR title song. And cut your way into thinking differently. And it's hard because what you want to do is you want to fall back on what you're used to. And some people do it because they don't know they have a choice. You have a choice. Listen to this freaking podcast 1,000 times if you have to convince yourself of that. You have a choice. We all have a choice. You want to know how obvious this is to some people? Do you guys remember, a small band back in the 60s? I don't know. What were they called? The Beatles? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, George Harrison wrote a song off the White record, the so-called White album, right? The double album that's white, right? And there's a song out there called Savoy Truffle, right? And this is like, I don't know, 68. I don't remember the exact year. I should have investigated this before I did this podcast. But no, I decided to be a slacker. Anyway, so the lyrics are, you know that what you eat, you are. But what is sweet now turns so sour, right? Now, if George Harrison knows that, that's kind of a frightening thought to think that you guys don't know that stuff. And I'm not suggesting George Harrison was an idiot, because he was not, on top of being a good musician. But, you know, you got to find this stuff out for yourself. You have control, right? There's another song off All Things Must Pass, right, which was done right after the Beatles broke up, George's first solo box set sort of thing, right? Everyone has choice. when to or not to raise their voices. It's you that decides. It's called run of the mill. Right? Go look it up if you think I'm kidding. Right? So if these guys know this stuff, you guys can do it, and so can you gals out there. Everybody can do it. You guys, you folks know when I say guys, I mean guys and gals. I'm not being sexist. I'm just being lazy. So cut me some slack here. But you control how you feel. You control your ultimate mental health state. When you throw your hands up and go, oh, my God, I just have depression. Or, oh, my God, depression runs in my family, so I guess I'm just doomed to be depressed. No, but if you tell yourself that crap, you will believe it. Stand in the mirror and look in the mirror and tell yourself what an ugly piece of shit you are, and you do it and you really mean it for about 3 or 4 years, you'll come to believe that, even if you're the best-looking gal or guy on the planet, right? If you hear it enough from somebody you trust, whether it's friends, family, cousins, girlfriend, boyfriend, yourself, whatever, you're going to believe it, even if it's not true, because you're going to think there's something weird about you because you believe differently. You can't base what you feel, do, or think on what other people think of you. You just can't. If you do that, you do not have self-esteem. You have what I call other esteem, because you're basing your esteem on what other people say or do, and that ain't self-esteem. Now, I'm not suggesting that you can't do check-ins with folks who you trust, folks who have your best, you know, interest at heart. But by and large, and I'm not suggesting it when catastrophic things happen to folks, when parents die, when, you know, they lose their job, when the economy takes a dump, when we get idiots in the White House or in any other, oops, did I say that? anyway, you know, when we get, you know, people running our lives we wish weren't running our lives, right? And by the way, I'm not slamming the current people in the government. I have had no use for the government for the last 30 years, so I'm an equal opportunity bigot. I'm not just picking on the people that are there now, so, you know, cut me some slack here. When you start doing that, you live for other people. You need to live for one person and one person alone, and that is yourself. Now, that doesn't mean you turn into a self-centered you-know-what, right? But that does mean that if you don't have healthy self-interest, right? Because let's face it, in the final analysis, all of us do what we do for us. So if you're one of these people who wants to cash in your brownie points at some later date by going, oh, I'm going to sacrifice myself and do this for you, because back in your mind, you're going, yeah, and in 2 weeks, I'm going to need a ride to the Rush concert, and I'm going to want your ass to drive me 4 hours to the Rush concert because I don't want to spend my gas. So I'm going to put myself out for you now and act like I'm some martyr so I can call in my brownie points. You know, no. That's not really, you know, that's not, you're not doing it for them. You're doing it for you, right? Ultimately, anybody should do everything they do for themselves. However, you know, if you're just doing it for you, and if you are the only person in your equation at all times, that's not a good thing either, right? So you have to be for yourself at all times, but you can't just be for yourself at all times. Sometimes it's in your best self-interest to be for other people, right? And I can tell you that while I do everything I do for me, a lot of what I do benefits other people too. And you guys have heard my spiel about that, which is, you know, what I call self-enhanced selfishness, right? And in a quick, you know, summary of that, because you guys are probably shaking your heads going, that sounds like an oxymoron. Right. Don't put a value judgment on the term selfishness. I'm talking about it in its operational term, focusing on the self, right? Because my argument is every single person on the planet, including Mother Teresa, right, is a selfish person. Now, Mother Teresa has what I call self-enhanced selfishness. What she does for herself because she feels it's right in the sight of herself and the sight of God. She feels good about doing it. Therefore, guess what? That's right. She's being selfish. However, her selfish acts help other people. It's a win-win situation. That's what I call self-enhanced selfishness. There's no getting around it. There are no humanitarians, in my personal opinion. Everybody's selfish. It's just, do we have people who are self-enhanced selfish, which is the only way to be if you really want to live in a great world? Or are you going to be a narcissist and do everything just for yourself and screw the guy or gal around you? You know, and you don't care what they think. You're just going to do what they think. You don't care about your impact on other, you know, your potential impact on other people's lives, right? That's narcissistic selfishness. Or you're going to be a martyr. You know, the person I just described earlier. Oh, I put myself out. Oh my God, now I'm helpless, and I need a ride to the Rush concert. Oh my God, you remember when I helped you out 3 weeks ago? Yeah, I call that, you know, being a martyr, self-enhanced. You know, that's masochistic selfishness. So you have masochistic selfishness. I'm putting myself out so I can call in my chips later. Narcissistic selfishness. I want my MTV, and I don't care if I have to beat the crap out of you and steal your money to get it, and I don't care if you die from hunger. And self-enhanced selfishness. I'm doing it for me, but what I'm doing also has a positive impact on other people. This is a cool deal, right? So I want to go back to the victimization thing, right? There isn't a person who probably hasn't been a victim of something, hasn't been victimized, right? Somebody's been hit in a car wreck that wasn't their fault. You know, somebody's had their job taken from under them through no fault of their own. Somebody, you know, has been, you know, done somebody wrong, you know, to go quote a line from a blues song. I think it's a No More James song, but don't quote me on that because I'm not sure. Again, sorry I didn't look that up prior to this, but, you know, shoot me. So, you know, everybody has things in their lives that happen to them that are beyond their control, right? You don't always have control over everything that happens to you, right? But you do have control over what you feel and do about it emotionally and physically. You don't have to beat the shit out of somebody who calls you an asshole. You don't have to flip them off if he called you an asshole. You feel like it, but you take the higher ground, right? Because think about it. If you are reacting to what somebody else does, you are giving them control of your emotions. And you're practicing being a reactionary person instead of a proactive person. The more you practice reactionary tactics, the more you groove those neural pathways, the more you feel like a victim, right? So everybody has been, quote unquote, a victim or has been victimized by something, whether it's assault, rape, you know, embezzlement, unfair firing, car accident, striked by lightning, had a heart attack when they were, you know, living a perfectly normal life because they had some genetic, you know, foobar through no fault of their own, whatever. You know, we all have had things like that happen to us at some point or another, sometimes repeatedly, right? So we have all been victimized by something beyond our control. But the difference between somebody who's been victimized and somebody who is a victim is that person stays in that victimized role. Oh my God, I've got depression. I can't help it. My mother has depression. My dad has depression. I just, you don't understand. I have depression. I have to be on these medications. No, you don't. Not necessarily. Have you gone for a brain scan? Do you know for a fact that you have a genetic depression situation? Have you tried not stuffing your face with all those Cheetos and eating all that goddamn sugar and all those hydrogenated fats that you eat? Have you tried exercising? Have you tried cognitive behavioral therapy? Have you tried meditating? Have you tried engaging in pleasurable activities to make yourself feel better instead of singing and whining and wanting people to go poor baby, right? Because you may not have to be on medication. And again, some people come to the table with FUBAR wiring and biochemistry through no fault of their own, and I recognize that those few people will need to be on something, whether it's a medication or a strict diet or both or whatever. But those folks are few and far between when you compare them to the general population, right? I think I said something about the depression podcast I did a ways back that, you know, less than 10% of every depressed person who says, oh, I have a chemical imbalance, you don't have a chemical imbalance. You have a chemical imbalance you induced, right? Because maybe something happened and you got depressed and something else happened and you got depressed and somebody told you it runs in your family and you thought you were helpless. You threw your hands up and started taking Prozac or whatever. No, I'm sorry, that doesn't count, right? Most people do not have a biogenic component to their emotions, except the one that they induce themselves, period, end of story. Now, you can't always choose what happens to you. You can't always choose who says what to you or who does what to you when or how much money you make or whatever. You know, there are all sorts of things that happen to us in life, right? But think of life as presenting challenges for us to exhibit our personal and emotional and mental mastery. Think of life as trying to build up our mastery skills and mastery muscles. Think of life as a way to build up our coping mechanisms in our head, aka create more healthy, more resilient, more strong, more healthy neural pathways. And think of what we can do to help them, whether it's diet, exercise, meditation, yoga, whatever. Right? Because we're really talking about chemistry here, brain chemistry. But you know, as my friend said many years ago, and you guys have heard this before on podcast, as you believe, so shall you do. And he was right. And too damn bad I didn't listen to him sooner. Right? That is so profound, because what this man is saying is that as you begin to think thoughts, you're creating neural pathways. Start to create neural pathways that aren't pissed off all the time, hurt all the time, emotionally upset all the time, histrionic all the time, depressed all the time, anxious all the time, fill in the blank. Don't you want to feel better? Aren't you tired of being sick and tired? You have a choice. We all have a choice. And if you are one of the small minority of folks who have a biogenical or a wiring problem or whatever, you still have a choice. You have a choice to take your medication appropriately or to see if you have some alternative if you don't like doing medication. Can you do a vitamin regimen? There are certain foods that we know enhance brain functioning. There are certain chemicals, proteins, right, amino acids, you know, Chinese herbs, whatever. There's tons of so-called holistic, organic, so-called organic, you know, healthy ways to help the brain think better. You know, omega-3 fish oils, omega-6, omega-9s. Those are all known to improve things like depression, anxiety, stress, yada, 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 right? So that doesn't mean you can't do medication if you're on those. It means you do both. You want to check it out with your physician to make sure you're not ODing your body or you don't have some weird allergy or whatever. But there's plenty of stuff you can do. You just don't throw your hands up and go, oh, I'm just going to take these Zoloft pills, or I'm going to take these Paxil pills, or I'm going to take whatever, and I'm just doomed to be depressed. Oh, my God. Right? No. You're doomed to be depressed because you doomed your ass to be depressed because you told yourself you were depressed and you believed it. You told yourself enough and you believed it. As you believe, so shall you do. And then your heart rate slowed down. You stopped producing as good chemicals in your brain. Depressed people produce less immune antibodies, so your T-cell production goes down, which means you're more susceptible to opportunistic diseases, which means you get sicker more, which increases your depression, which increases your bad cholesterol, yada, 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 yada. You folks have no clue, well, some of you may, how powerful a pharmacopedia you have in your brain. You have the power to do amazing things with your brain and your body. Honest to Jesus, God, Buddha, whatever. Right? You folks have amazing power. I mean it from the bottom of my heart. You folks have amazing power. Please stop giving it away. Please stop believing these clusterfucks that tell you, oh, you just have to whatever. Oh my God, you got in a wreck and, you know, you're paralyzed. And so now you have to feel sorry for yourself the rest of your life. Again, I'm not slamming people who, you know, are having an adjustment period and have some trauma. I mean, I get it. Okay, that's fine. You're feeling bad right now. Let's see what we can do to make it less bad. You don't want to be a victim all your life. You don't have a choice sometimes whether you're victimized or not, but you do have a choice whether you remain a victim or not, whether you remain in that role or not. That is completely and totally on you. It is not on the person that hit you and caused you to be paralyzed or whatever. Right? It's their responsibility that they did some structural damage to you, but it's your responsibility to get over it. Period, end of story. And I can tell you, no amount of revenge, no amount of money is going to fix the problem. No amount of that is going to correct your brain chemistry. That's got to come from inside. You have got to do it. You don't heal inside brain chemistry by using outside stuff to fix it. You start fixing it inside. You may enhance it with some outside stuff, whether it's fish oils or vitamins or protein shakes, or, you know, if you're one of those people that has to have Zoloft or Paxil or whatever. But you first and foremost work on it inside. Take your power back. Don't believe what other people say about you, right? Most of us like to be liked. But if you're not and you're happy with who you are, be happy with who you are and find a new group of people that'll accept you for who you are, right? And if that means you're alone on a mountaintop somewhere, better that than sell out who you are. Rather that than be a poser. Rather that than try to put a mask on and play a role in a movie that you don't even like. You know, because you play that mask on and you start playing that role, you begin at some point to forget who the hell you are. You know, with the real me, please stand up. And I can tell you that when I meet people and they're a different person, I mean a grossly, not just okay, they're putting a lid on their head because they're in a courtroom and they have to act all contrite, or yeah, they're at a concert, they're hooping and hollering, they don't do that in the office. Well, of course, that's inappropriate behavior at the office. But you know, when somebody is like a completely different person, right, in one scenario than they are in another, right, or they say one thing and they do something else, I start becoming, you know, uber paranoid of those people. I'm like, well, the real person, please stand. Who the hell am I dealing with? Right? And I generally, you know, back out of those kinds of relationships. I don't want to be around phonies, right? If you're weird, quote unquote, unusual, quote unquote, an abnormal person, you're a statistical outlier, very much like myself, right? Then be the best statistical outlier you can be, unless that's, you know, John Wayne Gacy or Charles Manson. You're out there killing people or encouraging people to kill people. That's not a good thing, right? But barring something of that nature, be the best unusual guy or gal you can be. I don't care what that is. Be the best street sweeper you can be. Be the best musician you can be. Be the best doctor you can be. Be the best lawyer or plumber or electrician or housewife or house husband or whatever the heck it is you do. Be the best person you can be that's genuinely you. And if you don't know who you is, now is a great time to start looking. And don't be afraid, right? You're going to see stuff you don't like. Okay, what do you do with clothes you don't like? You throw them out or you give them to Goodwill. And you buy new clothes you do like. You find something about your personality you don't like, figure out how you're going to change it. Come see somebody like me. Go read a popular book that makes sense to you. Go talk to some buddies, you know, your minister, whatever. Figure out a way to channel, you know, to channel that energy and reform your personality in a way that you like. But make it authentic. Make it you. Make it real. Do not put on false faces for people. Have the courage and the intestinal fortitude and the moral integrity to be what you are. Do not be like most politicians and used car dealers, the so-called stereotypes, right? Be who you are and be proud of it, right? And if you're afraid to wave your weird flag in public, then you know what? Remove yourself and be in a situation where you're just, you know, laying low, doing whatever. But if you think you're going to get kicked in the butt, whatever. But do what you are and don't sell out. Don't change who you are to suit other people. You're never going to be happy. The road to happiness is internal happiness, not, you know, how many sex partners you have, not how big your schlong is, not how many guitars you have in your closet or cars you have in your garage or houses you own or money you have in your bank or how many good looks you have or how many NBA, you know, championship rings you have or any, you know, none of that matters. I mean, it's great if you have that stuff. That's wonderful. More power to you. I'm happy for you. But if you're not happy inside, you ain't happy. And you can only live for one person, and that's you. But you can't be a narcissistic, selfish person. You have to consider other people as you're going through life, unless you're just sitting on a mountaintop somewhere. And if that's your stick, that's fine. Right? Be the best hermit you can be. Right? Don't be in some cabin, figuring out a doomsday bomb. You know. Do what you do best. As long as it doesn't hurt yourself or somebody else, right? Be the best person you can be because you matter. Create new pathways for yourself. Create new neural pathways. Create new biochemistry inside your body. You can do it. Anybody listening to this podcast practically can do that. This is not a skill for people with 150 plus IQs or people, you know, with Harvard degrees or Yale degrees or, you know, University of California, Berkeley, or whatever, you know, whatever great, you know, the great universities or whatever. This is for everybody on the planet. Become self-actualized, actualize, become aware, and do it for yourself first and foremost. Don't do it for anybody else but you, because you're worth it. Period. End of story. And so in that regard, I salute William Glasser. I salute people like Albert Ellis, and Aaron Beck, the founders of cognitive and behavioral therapy and rational motive therapy, Maxine Maltzby, rational behavior therapy, Alfred Adler, the individual therapy, the natural logical consciousness guy, because all of these people are saying essentially the same thing. You are in charge of your life. Take charge of it because it's worth it, and you don't want to give it to somebody else to run. Not a good idea. Thanks for listening. Sorry for the raving. Check me out on those musical dillies if you want, just to keep me honest. And I'll see you guys and gals again soon. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Be awesome.